Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Take a dried black bean or any dried bean or any bead the size of a bean and a toddler, and the next thing you know, you have a foreign object up a nose. And that's not as easy to remove as you might think. Joining us now is Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center emergency room physician, Columbus Dispatch columnist, and executive director of the Office of Global Health, Dr. Diane Gorgas. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann. Good to be back.
Let's talk about the bean in the nostril issue. You wrote about a similar situation in a recent column. Tell us what happened.
It's almost inevitable that when there are toddlers who are exploring the world, they do it not only visually and through sound, and they're very tactile little creatures, and they will take anything and rub it against anywhere that feels good, and frequently that is right up a nose or into an ear. So this was a toddler just over a year old, just ambulatory, beginning to speak. Older sister was beating in the family room, and the toddler proudly toddled into the kitchen and told Mommy, "Bead gone, up nose." And there you have it.
I mean, sometimes you probably have people bringing their kids in. They don't even know what's up there because the kid can't even tell them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And oftentimes we look
It up there and they forget.
Right. And they do forget. And we have to look for other associated signs or symptoms that there may be a foreign body. Every once in a while, we actually pick these up when there's a complaint of deafness and a child has stuck a bead in the ear and it just languishes there. Frequently, there's drainage associated with it or difficulty breathing if it's in the nose or difficulty hearing if it's in the ear. But sometimes these things can go undetected for a while.
And beads are typical?
Beads are absolutely typical. They're perfectly sized. They're nice and smooth and shiny, and they feel good against the skin. But they're vexing to remove. There are no irregular edges on a bead to grasp onto with a pair of forceps to drag them out.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about foreign objects in the wrong places, particularly nostrils and ears of young children. My guest is Dr. Diane Gorgas. She's an emergency room physician at the Wexner Medical Center, and she also writes a column for the Columbus Dispatch. You might have seen it. We're talking about the topic of one, that is those foreign objects in the nostril. I loved hearing some of the descriptions about how you've tried to get these things out in the past, including glue on a toothpick.
Yeah, exactly. We have hospital-grade Q-tips, cotton-tipped applicators, and you can put some super glue on. I don't recommend this to any of our listeners at home.
It doesn't work.
But there were some papers out 10, 15 years ago that said you could put a drop of super glue on the end of the wooden part or the handle part of a cotton-tipped applicator, put it into the offending orifice, the nostril or into the ear, have ultimate patience as that super glue dries for 10 or 15 seconds, and then just be able to extract it. I've tried it a couple times. A couple times was enough for me to realize it was less than ideal for this. And that's when we came up with this other method, which is actually using air to force the foreign body out of the
nose. How did you find out about that?
It was probably initially published about 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And I can't lay claim to it, but I thought it was brilliant when I read it. The whole idea behind the concept is that you make a tight seal over the toddler or the patient's mouth, give a quick burst of air. So it's not a sustained, lengthy, there aren't multiple breaths that you do. It's just one single hard and fast. And the air can only go one of two places. Some of it goes down into the lungs, but a lot of it goes up into the nasal cavity. And if you've occluded one side of the nose without the bead in it, and the only side of the only nostril that's open is the one with the offending agent, then frequently that bead or bean or whatever it may be, seed pit will come flying out at that time.
So that means plug the non-offending nostril.
Correct.
And do something like a CPR routine with mouth to mouth.
Right. A really forcible CPR breath.
And I liked it how you had the mother sort of joking around and tickling the little, you know, the toddler and making this a fun thing.
Absolutely.
As soon as the toddler thinks something's up,
Right. They tense up and they're not going to – it's really necessary that the patient or the toddler in this case kind of have an open airway and be relaxed so that you can get some air into the mouth.
And then if the bead or the bean or whatever the offending object is in the ear, what do you recommend people do?
Yeah, that's a whole nother ball of wax.
Right.
No pun intended, or maybe pun intended. That's something else we have to go after in ears. But if it's a bead in the ear, one of the most effective ways to remove it is actually to use some water irrigation. Again, this is not something that you want to try at home, the water irrigation. And it really depends on the orientation of the bead. The water almost has to go through the hole in the bead to create enough pressure, back force pressure, that the bead will come out. The difficulty, if it's a bean or a seed pit or anything that's organic, if you're trying to irrigate it, is that it'll suck up water. And it'll become edematous or swollen within the ear and make it all the more difficult to come out. So with ears, we have an option of, under direct visualization, taking a small pair of forceps that have a long stalk on them to actually be able to go in and grab the foreign body and pull it out. Again, the difficulty is with beads because there's just nothing to hold on to.
Now, any of this stuff, even with the blowing into the mouth to expel the object from a nostril, is this something you still want people to have a professional around to observe and guide?
So the biggest difficulty, the biggest complication that we're concerned about is the possibility of a nasal foreign body becoming a foreign body in the posterior oropharynx. So in other
which
words,
which is what?
Which is further in the further back in the back of the mouth.
Oh, okay.
Which subsequently could be sucked into a bronchus.
In the lung.
And, right, and turn into an airway emergency. So that's why I think it's a reasonable idea to do this under a controlled setting.
Okay.
In other words, go to the hospital, let us do it, or let us talk you through it.
Is this becoming more prevalent because of the whole beading craze that doesn't seem to be going away? I call it a craze, but beading seems to be here to stay, like coloring almost.
Yeah, exactly. I think I've seen more beads than other organic foreign bodies recently just because of that. But probably there's not a month or two that goes by when I don't see some sort of foreign body in a toddler or in an adult, for that matter.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Dr. Diane Gorgas, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. We welcome that. You can also tweet us at WOSU All Sides. You know, reading some of your columns got me thinking about what you do in the emergency room and how you manage things when a patient comes in thinking that they know exactly what's wrong and how they're doing it not for no good reason. They probably have a lot of good reasons why they're thinking that way, and how you unpack those stories and reassemble stuff so that it makes sense from where you're sitting.
Yeah, there's kind of a running joke in medicine right now that one of your most vexing consultants on any case is Dr. Google, because that's what every patient has sought as an alternative opinion. I love patients that have taken the time to self-educate, who have explored their symptoms, and who have bothered to engage with their disease process as opposed to being truly passive recipients of the healthcare system. So I applaud them for doing that. The nuances of trying to dissuade somebody away from what we call in medicine, it's a cognitive error called early anchoring or early closure, in which you have one diagnosis and the disease process could only be that single diagnosis. Despite the constellation of symptoms expanding over multiple organ systems and truly very well could be attributable to multiple different diseases, frequently patients will develop early closure. And the early closure more typically has to do with catastrophic diagnoses. Is this cancer? Is this a heart attack? Those are the situations where when I don't think that the patient has come to the right diagnosis, it's a pleasure to talk them away from that. But sometimes it is a challenge. And one of the first questions that I like to ask patients is, you know, when you came in, what were you worried that I might diagnose you with? What was your concern? I need to make sure that I address that concern with you, and then I don't leave it as a lingering question.
Mm-hmm. So you can nip it in the bud if it's a problem, or it can maybe give you some insights into something deeper.
I may have a 10-minute eloquent discussion with the patient describing why I think they have an ulcer. And if I haven't addressed their concern that this could be cancer and either dissuaded them from that or given them definitive proof that that is not the situation, they'll leave dissatisfied. So it's important to make sure that you, as a patient, communicate that to your physician, really what you're concerned about.
Just even talking about the bean in the nose thing, mm-hmm. How much does it help you as an emergency room physician to know how it happened?
I think a lot of times it makes a big difference how it happened.
Versus, like, say it's the 4-year-old brother put it in the toddler's nose versus the toddler put it in its nose.
Yeah, exactly. And you have to, especially in children and in elders, we have truly an epidemic of elder neglect going on right now. You really have to drill down to the details. Does the history that you're getting from the provider, whoever that may be that's bringing in the patient, mm-hmm. does it match with what you're finding on physical exam? My career is truly riddled with cases where there was a doubt. It may have been the explanation that was given, but it also may not have been the explanation that was given. And we are very concerned watching out for the health and well-being of especially those two particular age groups, the very young and the very old. We tend to have a lot of suspicions about histories occur and how they occur.
You wrote another column that I thought about a lot, a piece about how knowing a patient's weight and weight changes can be instrumental in diagnosing. Tell us a little bit about that story and what it helped you learn.
So this was a patient that came in with an abnormal cardiac rhythm. And there are a lot of reasons to have this particular abnormal cardiac rhythm, which is called atrial fibrillation. It's where the top two chambers of the heart kind of beat in a very uncoordinated fashion, and the bottom two chambers, the ventricles, just struggle to keep up. So her heart rate was about 180, faster than any marathoner should be when they're in the middle of running a very strenuous race. There are a lot of different reasons for that, as I said. One of the more vexing reasons is actually an endocrine reason, is hyperthyroidism can cause this. And without an antecedent history, knowing that this was a thin, middle-aged woman who previously was about 15 to 20 pounds heavier, and gaining that history that she had lost that 15 to 20 pounds over the last month unintentionally. Mm-hmm. So not trying to lose weight. Her daughter, when I said, you know, has there been any weight loss? Said, well, look at her pants. And admittedly, she was in a hospital gown with her pants on. I lifted up the gown and her pants there were dozens of pleats on the front of her pants that were not put there by the pant manufacturer. She mm-hmm. was wearing a pair of pants that was at least 3 or 4 sizes too big for her. And it was because of this weight loss that she had had. And that was, it's a subtle clue, but a clear-cut clue to the reason for her abnormal heart rhythm. And it opened up an entirely new treatment arm for her that we wouldn't have considered otherwise.
And was it something, I mean, it could be the sign of a lot of things that aren't so good.
Absolutely.
Unintentional weight loss. Ironically, we're going to be talking about women over 50 and the struggles they have with weight loss, but coming up later in the program, but unintentional weight loss is a sign of something.
Absolutely. If you have been struggling to maintain your weight, either a healthy weight, either you're chronically underweight or you're chronically overweight, and all of a sudden your struggles go away, you start gaining weight when you've always had problems keeping weight on, or you start losing weight when that's always been a struggle for you, absolutely, that should prompt a visit to a physician. There are a number of different conditions that can cause that. And fortunately, like in this woman, a number of them are very reversible. Hyperthyroidism was not a malignant diagnosis for her. So it was easy to treat.
Okay, well, Dr. Gorgas, thank you so much for joining us today. As always, informational. Dr. Diane Gorgas, she's at the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. As you age, your body changes. There are probably plenty of baby boomers out there who will vouch for this. Weight is a prime example and a big problem. So what's the deal? Joining us now by phone is Ohio Health Grant Medical Center registered dietitian, Miranda Stone. Welcome to the show, Miranda.
Thanks so much, Ann.
So what is it about our metabolism that changes once we hit 40 or 50, and why isn't there a pill for it?
Well, I think there's a lot of things to consider when you're talking about your metabolism. And as we age, I don't think it's necessarily that our metabolism is slowing. It's just that we're losing muscle mass. So, you know, we know from observing elite athletes that we start to lose muscle mass somewhere in our 30s and our 40s. We're just not quite sure how much we start losing then. Population studies, though, have showed that around the age of 50, we start to lose about 1 to 2% of our muscle mass per year. At age 60, we start to lose 3% per year, and then by age 70, we've ended up with this 20 to 40% loss. And I think a couple things affect that, one of those being, you know, not getting enough physical activity in our daily lives, which I think most of us are guilty of. So to prevent that, I think one of the things we need to think about is making sure we're getting that strength training in. And, you know, they recommend 60 to 90 minutes a day of daily activity. So that's a big part of what changes our metabolism, along with changes in hormones, nerve cell loss, vascular changes, and that type of thing.
Why do we lose muscle mass as we age?
Well, we lose the muscle mass. One thing is vascular changes. So we don't get as much blood flow into our muscle cells, and so we start to lose that muscle. Another thing is from nerve cell loss, which is, you know, a signal to the brain to tell our muscles to continue to contract, and so we lose that. And another reason is, you know, our body becomes a little more acidic as we get older, our kidneys. And so the acid that's produced actually breaks down that muscle. And this leads to more fat in the cells as well.
Is there anything diet-wise that we could do to slow down any of those processes?
I think a big one is, first of all, okay, so as you start to reach, like, your 50s, you know, you start to lose estrogen, you start to lose testosterone. I think it's important that before you hit that, to start decreasing your caloric intake by about 200 calories a day. And that'll help you offset some of that unwanted weight gain. As far as, you know, specific foods that you want to eat, I think our body doesn't absorb nutrients as well as we get older. So some of the things that they really want you to focus on, you know, at age 50 and older is calcium, vitamin D, fiber, potassium, and B12. So those focusing on those types of things is going to help you with that weight gain.
And that's why they, you know, recommend the silver vitamins to people as they age?
That's right. And, you know, I also recommend for some people, because protein is so important in the older population, and they recommend about 1 to 1.2 grams per kilogram a day. So we're looking at like a 120-pound person. We need about 55 to 66 grams of protein a day. And something to consider also is making sure that those proteins are complete proteins. They especially think about leucine when they're thinking of a complete protein, because that helps with protein synthesis. And you'd find that in things like nuts, fish, meat, chicken, your dairy products like milk and soy. So I sometimes will recommend if people can't get enough protein in within their daily intake, to maybe consider like a protein supplement powder, you know, that you could add to like a smoothie in the morning or to your oatmeal. And that's a great source of a complete protein, too.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the problems of weight gain and the struggle to lose weight after 40 or especially 50. If you have a question or comment for my guest, registered dietitian Miranda Stone, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to go back to the losing muscle mass issue. So when you're losing muscle mass, that means the muscles aren't burning as many calories?
Correct. Okay. And that's why you see that drop in your metabolic rate, because, of course, the more muscle mass you have, the more calories you're burning. So as we lose that muscle mass, we also are at risk for gaining more weight. And the average woman, you know, around 50, needs somewhere between 1,000 and 1,600 calories a day.
Just for normal?
Yes, correct.
But if you're going to that 60 to 90 minutes a day that you recommend for exercise, then you're looking at a little more?
Sometimes, you know, it just depends.
Yeah.
And most of the people that I see on a day-to-day basis still fall within that range, somewhere between around 1,200 to 1,600 calories a day. And, you know, one thing I find is most people will come to me and say, you know, I'm physically active every day and I'm eating really healthy, but I'm still gaining the weight. And then, you know, they have this fitness app called MyFitnessPal that I love, and mm-hmm. you start to look through their food diary and you realize, yeah, they're eating healthy, but I think they don't realize that even though you're eating healthy, you can still overeat those items. And, you know, a calorie is a calorie at the end of the day. It doesn't matter if you're eating a half a cup of brown rice or a half a cup of white rice. At the end of the day, it's still rice and the same amount of calories. You're still getting more nutrients from that brown rice, but at the end of the day, it's still calories in, calories out.
I've interviewed one or both of the authors of the Younger Next Year series in the past, and they say that older people, and I'm meaning starting from 40 on and especially into the 50s and 60s, start doing exactly the wrong thing. They start exercising less.
Yes, and that's also partly, you know, with a decrease in estrogen and testosterone, you have less energy. And so you do see that around the age of 50, people usually will become less physically active. Then they're losing more muscle mass on top of it. And so then you see more weight gain. So they're not really sure if it's, you know, the decline in hormone levels or if it's just the decline in overall physical activity that's actually causing that weight gain.
Yeah, it's hard to suss it out. So somebody who had a great exercise routine 3 days a week, you know, doing something, that's not going to sustain them going forward.
Correct. And I myself have seen that, you know, being an avid runner from the age of 20, you know, I could eat a whole pizza from Donato's and I used to run 8 miles a day, but for sure, I could not do that now and maintain my weight. Things change.
Things change. And you did mention menopause playing a factor in women. Is there anything parallel for men?
It's the same thing. They lose testosterone just like we lose estrogen, and then you see that decline in their overall energy, and you see less physical activity. And, you know, once those hormones decline, you also see more fat accumulating in the abdominal region versus like in the thighs and the buttocks area.
Right. The weight shifts.
It does shift. And they're not really sure why that shift happens.
60 to 90 minutes a day sounds like a lot to a lot of people.
It does. But, you know, I think you'll find fitting that in, you'll see an increase in your overall energy output, and you'll just see better results, I think, overall.
And when you talk about weight training, talk about that, because we hear a lot about that in terms of bone health.
Absolutely. They say for every pound of weight that you take off, you're taking 4 pounds of pressure off your joints. So making sure that your muscles are being built, you know, staying strong, you're able to support those joints. And that's why it's so much healthier for your bones.
If you have a question or comment about weight gain after 50, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what kinds of foods do older people need to eat? To consume if they're trying to maintain a weight?
You know, I think it's around the board the same for everybody. We all need to follow the same basic diet, you know, low fat, eating our whole grains. I tell people, shop the perimeter of the grocery store. You're getting your fruits, your vegetables, your meats, your whole grains, your dairies. You're getting everything that you need in. It's once you start going down those aisles with the processed foods and stuff that you start getting a lot of things that you don't need. They're high in calories, high in fat, and, you know, I just teach a well-rounded diet is probably the best way to go.
And then the idea of being tired more, how do you recommend people work through that in a safe way? So maybe when I would go on a 20-mile bike ride 20 years ago, I could go really fast the whole time. Now just get on the bike and ride it. How do you know how much exertion, I guess?
And I guess that varies person to person, mm-hmm. depending on how much you can do. You know, pacing yourself, obviously, if you're not used to getting in that physical activity, I always recommend people starting off slow, you know, do a mile walk a night or, you know, start off with going around the block and slowly increase that physical activity. And one other thing I wanted to touch on was just a hormone called ghrelin. And, you know, ghrelin is what is responsible for making us feel hungry. And so it's really important to make sure you're keeping that in control during the day. And they recommend that, you know, some of the things, you know, first of all, getting a diet that's high in good carbs, whole grains and high protein is one thing to keep it in control. The protein helps keep your metabolism up, and then the carbs kind of help keep that ghrelin to a minimal level. Making sure you're getting enough sleep, at least 8 hours a night, because if your ghrelin will rise if you're not getting enough sleep, and this they've seen especially true in women. Not skipping your meal, so ghrelin will tend, after you eat, the level of ghrelin in your body will actually decrease for about 3 to 4 hours. So that's why they recommend that, you know, 6 small meals a day, because you're keeping that under control, that ghrelin level. And then eat within an hour of waking. And that's so much so that, you know, when you go to eat your breakfast, that level of ghrelin hasn't risen so much that you're starving. And it's just, you know, all diets go out the window when that ghrelin level rises too far. And then also making sure that you're staying hydrated. This helps regulate your metabolism. This regulates fat burning. And you can also mistake, you know, the feeling of thirst for hunger. So that's another thing to just keep in mind when you're thinking about diet and maintaining your weight.
The whole water thing. Now, some people, once you get to a certain age, too much water can be hurtful too.
Correct. And I usually recommend most people to be around 2,000 milliliters a day, 2 liters. Mm-hmm. And it varies person to person. You're taking into account their height, their weight, their activity levels, and that all plays a part in how much water you need every day.
I read that, you know, when you're working out, when you're exercising and getting, you're burning more fuel, your body tells you you need more fuel, but then people tend to keep up the same rate of eating on days where they're not exercising as much.
Correct. They do that. And I usually will tell people during counseling that, you know, on the days you exercise, I usually give them an extra 100 to 200 calories a day, depending. But on your days off, if you're not up and moving around, you definitely need less calories.
How much does what you eat affect a workout within an hour or two? How do you know when to eat relative to a workout in general? I know it differs with different people, but...
Usually I say before a workout, at least 1 to 2 hours before, I like to get something with a good amount of carb and protein in it. So, you know, it could be something as simple as a bowl of cereal or, you know, some oats with some protein powder in it. But then definitely after you work out, you want to eat within 1 to 2 hours after your workout, because that's when your body is restoring all of its glucose cells.
So when I used to work out early in the morning, that was an issue. I wasn't hungry and I didn't eat before I worked out. I'd eat afterward. But when I work out later at night now, I don't want to come home and eat.
Yeah, and so I always recommend packing like a protein bar with you or something in the car that you can eat on the way home from the gym.
Okay.
You know, if it's in the morning, I always recommend, you know, something small and light. I'm not a breakfast person either, but I kind of make myself eat something small, like, you know, a sandwich thin with a little bit of peanut butter on it or, you know, a granola bar so that I know I'm not starving by the time, it is time to eat something real.
In general, I mean, the message seems to be, though, and continues to be, as you age, you need to exercise on a daily basis more.
I don't know about more. I think, you know, 60 to 90 minutes of daily activity for everybody is fairly healthy. And I know that's not possible in most people's busy schedules. But, you know, even if it means taking a lunch break and going out and just walking for 30 minutes if you can, I mean, that's really just going to improve your overall, your mental health, your physical health, and it's going to improve your sleep at night. And I think you're able to control other things in your life, like your food, when that kind of stuff is taken care of.
And you like some of those apps out there that help people with that.
Oh, yeah. I love the MyFitnessPal app. And also, you know, like the Fitbit activity tracker, that kind of thing. I think it really puts in perspective how much activity you're getting in through the day. And, you know, I recently had bought my mom one of the Fitbits, and she told me, she's like, you know, I just love it, because she can track how much she's walking during the day. And not only that, she's linked it up to her calorie intake, which now she's like, you know, I really didn't realize how much was in this food that I was eating until I started writing it down, and it was in my face how many calories and how much fat was in a serving. And, you know, I've seen that even for myself when I started tracking my calories. You don't always realize what you're eating has so much in it until you're actually paying attention. So some of these apps really raise your awareness, and that's what I like so much about them.
Well, Miranda Stone, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Oh, no problem. It was my pleasure, Ann.
Miranda Stone, she's a registered dietitian at Ohio Health Grant Medical Center. Coming up, we're going to talk about busy, 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 and the stress associated with being too busy or too stressed out at work. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Busy. It's worn like a badge. Coming in early, staying really late. When did leaving work on time become an act of courage?
That's a clip from a new Hyundai commercial, which uses the growing trend of work-related stress and the go-go-go mindset to sell cars. So a car company is trying to make money from the image, but those who experience real work stress risk serious health consequences, and a new car probably isn't going to solve that problem. A recent New York Times article about workplace stress at Amazon got us thinking about the larger issue. Amazon isn't the only workplace with stress. Joining us now by phone is burnout prevention expert and author of Addicted to Busy, Paula Davis Lack. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks so much for having me on.
That New York Times expose on Amazon's work culture brings up this idea of work, 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 go, go, go all the time. What is all of this job-related stress doing to our minds and our bodies?
Well, for the simple answer is that it's really wearing us out. And, you know, you are correct in saying that Amazon certainly isn't the only company that is experiencing a lot of stressed out workers. And quite honestly, the pace that we're going at in so many businesses and organizations is really unsustainable. So I think that we've gotten into the habit, or organizations have gotten into the habit, of thinking of our workers or our employees as machines who can simply just go and go and go. And that's just not the case.
Because stress does things to us. The thing we need more than anything, sleep, stress directly affects that.
Stress is a huge target on sleep. And what's interesting is that I was just doing some research for an article on sleep and the importance of it. And what's interesting is that companies lose about $63 billion a year in lost productivity, absenteeism, work-related accidents and such, simply from workers showing up who don't have enough sleep. That's a lot.
How much does this have to do with our culture? Are Americans addicted to work? It's not just some boss saying work harder necessarily, is it?
That's part of it, but I think there absolutely is a mentality around, you know, achievement and, you know, let's get the most money and let's, you know, get the race, you know, to the first products being to market. And some of that is great. I mean, I don't think we want to say that, you know, the competitive nature of work and really achieving and innovating and all of those things are things that we want to go away. It's more about how we go about doing it. And what's really interesting is I've had an opportunity to travel around the world for my work and had some interesting conversations with folks, particularly in Australia, who brought up the exact thing that you're just talking about. And they said, what's going on with you Americans? You guys are just crazy in terms of working to live instead of living to work.
It's funny you bring up Australia because I remember an experience when I was there following the governor around, the governor of Ohio. He took a day off that day and everyone else did too. But I was a reporter and I went and did another story and traveled. And I was with a couple of women, Australians, who were taking me somewhere to a company, to a plant. And they said, why aren't you out at the beach? And
said, they know, right?
They said, what, are you crazy? And I thought I still needed. They sent me all the way to Australia. I still need to pump out another story. But no
That's
one.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And I think, too, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, Americans tend to look at other cultures and say, oh, my gosh, how do Europeans get 6 or 7 weeks of vacation? Isn't that crazy? What are they doing? They should be working, you know, and they're looking at us saying, why are you guys wasting so many vacation days? And why are you only taking the bare minimum and not spending enough time with your family?
That is a problem. People don't take all their vacation time.
No, there's, I can't remember the exact statistic, but there are hundreds of millions of unused vacation days by people in the United States every year.
According to a recent survey by Alliance Global Assistance, it found that 56% of Americans say they haven't taken a vacation in the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. And many of those who are taking vacations still check their emails. So
yep.
There's this whole thing of unplugging on vacation, too.
Yes, which is really hard to do. And some of it comes from just the pressure, I think, that we feel. A lot of people are doing, you know, the work of 2 or 3 people at their company. So there really is a huge amount of workload and workload pressure that they have to deal with. Some of it, though, is also the internal messages that we say to ourselves around what it means to be successful, what it means to look like we're being a hard worker. And some of those, you know, mechanisms are hard to turn off, even on vacation. And I have to say that, you know, I was one of those people. When I was a practicing lawyer, I took a long weekend vacation every now and then, but I went 4 years without taking an extended vacation, which is completely unsustainable.
Wait, you were a lawyer?
I was. I'm a recovering lawyer, which I tell people in jest, a recovering lawyer, yes.
You've been on both sides. Law firms are notorious.
Yes. Yes, they certainly are. They could certainly benefit from some of these stress management and stress resilience type practices, for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about what burnout is and what some of the signs of burnout are. Sometimes people don't realize they've crossed that line.
Yes. I mean, we all have this sort of optimal stress zone that we like working in, and it's different for everybody. There's a certain amount of stress that we can handle on a daily basis and, you know, really finish the day with energy and go home and, you know, meet all of the demands that we have after work. But I define burnout as a work-related process of chronic stress and disengagement. So some important words in that definition are that we're talking about this being chronic. So you don't wake up one day all of a sudden and go, hey, I think I'm burned out. You know, this is something that's probably been manifesting over a period of time that really causes you to unplug, as I call it, from things that give you a lot of energy and vitality.
Why does it lead to unplugging from things that give you energy and vitality?
Sure. It's because so the burnout formula is really specific. So it's a combination of having too many job demands. So those are the things that take consistent time and energy from your day. Too few job resources. So those are the things that give you all of the engagement and the motivation and help you achieve your goals. And too little recovery. So that balance or that formula gets thrown off for a consistent period of time, and that's what starts to lead people down the path to burnout.
When you talked about the cost to businesses of all this stress, what do we know about how businesses and business leaders are responding to this? Jeff Bezos sounded stunned, you know, at all of this, but when you read the rules of the road for Amazon, I mean, just having all those rules about how what an Amazonian is supposed to be like is kind of crazy.
Well, I think just the rules itself could probably be a job demand in and of itself for the people who work there, right? You know, that takes sustained effort and energy to go through your day going, am I following the rules? Did I miss a rule? Is somebody going to ding me because I did the rule wrong? You know, to kind of have that constant pressure following you around throughout the day, you know, it can be difficult. But I think workplaces are starting to get it. The great thing is that we have so much. There's such a great body of research that's been built up probably over the last 30 years or so, talking about, you know, what motivates employees, the importance of engagement, what companies can really benefit from when their workers are engaged and thriving and happy.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Paula Davis Lack. She's a resilience and burnout prevention expert and author of the book Addicted to Busy. Love to hear your stories. We have a few minutes left and like to hear your stories from listeners about things that cause stress in your office or where you work, whether it's an office or a manufacturing plant, a warehouse, retail. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your comment there. I mentioned law offices are notorious for the 80-hour work weeks, the 100-hour work weeks, that kind of a thing. What other businesses or jobs are super high stress?
So we're seeing a lot of burnout right now across the board, really, but particularly in healthcare. So we've got some research showing that one in three doctors are experiencing burnout at any given point in time. It's really hitting nurses hard as well. So healthcare is really toward the top of the list. I would put that right up there with the legal profession. In addition, a lot of teachers are burning out. I just did some work with a school district here in Wisconsin and was just shocked to find out that I think it was about one in three teachers leave the profession before 5 years. So that's for a lot of different reasons, but I know a lot of the teachers are starting to come forward and say, "Wow, I'm really burned out. Help!"
And I'm really burned out. That's saying something. That's complicated. I mean, like you said, when we talk about what burnout is, it's not something that just happens overnight.
It's not something that happens overnight, and it is complicated. I burned out during the last year of my law practice, and that's really what prompted me to go back and start to study what burnout is and how stress impacts us, particularly at work. As I started to peel back all the layers, that was one of the biggest things that I discovered was that, gosh, this is just not a simple, this isn't a simple process. The solutions are simple to execute, but there's lots of different ways to go about tackling the issue. So there's not one simple warning sign or one simple cause.
Brent in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brent.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
I'm intrigued by the title of your book, Addicted to Busy, and I'll confess I am an unrecovered attorney. I do practice law, and I love being busy. And I'm wondering, the law is always like up and down. You're either slammed or you're kind of twiddling your thumbs. And I'm wondering, for those of us who love being busy, not being busy is stressful in and of itself. Can that be a source of stress for those of us who are addicted to busy? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Brent.
Yeah, so I love that question. So the answer is absolutely yes. So we know that boredom, when you don't have enough stress, is as stressful as being way too busy, which can, you know, lead to that burnout. So I'm actually somebody who loves to be busy too. The key is to make your busyness purposeful. So many of us are busy, but we're adding things to our plate just because we want to impress other people or because we think we need to make sure that our kids are in five different activities and other things. But the important piece is that your busyness should be purposeful. But busyness generally can be a very good thing.
You know, you just made a comment there about children. Are we passing this on to our children?
I think we have to be pretty careful about how we are looking at the messages that we send to our kids, because I know I talk about, you know, if I trace my burnout way, way back, I could probably go back to high school when the messages that I got from my parents and my coaches and my teachers, who were all very well-meaning and very well-intentioned, were, can you add another advanced placement class to your schedule? What about another sport? How about, you know, class president? And so we start to take those messages to heart and forget about sending the same messages around. Yeah, it's really important to take a break, too. It's really important to stop and pause and, you know, just think about, is this something that you want to do? What do you want to do? What activities do you really like? And we're starting to see the rates of depression have just skyrocketed in teenagers, such that about 1 in 5 experience an episode of depression prior to graduating from high school.
And then another issue I wanted to bring up with you is higher pay. Does it help? Or do we find just as much stress in higher paying jobs as we do in lower paying jobs?
Yeah, I think the more important thing to look at is whether you fit well with the job that you're in. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you could be making a ton of money at a job and still experience, you know, have a lot of stress, but be able to handle it because, you know, the job gives you a lot of meaning. You're really tapped into doing something that you really love. So that can buffer that a little bit as well.
Okay. And then as far as the pay goes, I mean, besides that, the buffer of money can be a buffer. In other words, when you do take that vacation, you can get away from it all.
You can get away from it all. It doesn't mean you have to take necessarily the fancy vacations,
right,
and whatnot. You know, you can take a staycation and still get that. But I think there's some happiness research out there talking about generally above the level, I think, the cutoff, and you can take this with a grain of salt, of about $75,000. So when we have enough money to get our basic needs met, then we don't see generally additional huge upswings in happiness above that amount.
What about meditation? How is, or yoga or different sort of mindfulness activities? Have you seen any kind of uptick in that? I sort of have anecdotally, but I don't know.
Yes. So mindfulness is really sort of the set of skills of the moment right now. There's a lot of research that's going on in this area. And one of I have a blueprint for burnout prevention that I call stress resilience. And part of that is practicing safe stress. So one of my components of practicing safe stress is mindfulness. And so I use really simple mindfulness techniques, just a couple of breathing exercises that I do before an event or if I'm feeling stressed out, that help me immensely.
And do we see that more people are partaking? I mean, you can just look at the numbers for yoga, for different kinds of groups like that, and they're increasing.
Yes. So the numbers, yes. The numbers are going up a lot. And I think people are starting to look at some of these contemplative practices as a way to at least maybe ease their way into some sort of a stress management practice. And one of the apps that I really like is an app called Headspace that can help just people who are interested in wanting to take a look at maybe exploring meditation or a little bit with mindfulness just to get started. And I find it really helpful.
All right. Well, Paula Davis-Lack, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ann.
I feel better already.
Oh, good.
Paula Davis-Lack, she's a resilience and burnout prevention expert and author of the book Addicted to Busy. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, and video production is by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And you can follow me, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.